and I intended to avoid certain topics, and because I did, a few of the brethren felt that I had not dealt with what they wanted, but I specifically said there are things that Christ did not intend initially to reveal, and things that I did not intend to make a primary issue in the first topic. I should like to continue the subject today, which is, of course, why some few are here who are not regularly here. I would like to discuss some areas that we had not discussed in prophecy before, but for the few of you who were not here then, I would draw attention to the broad perspective that the issue and the focus of prophecy is not what men are about to do in the latter days. The issue all through history and the prophets is what God is about to do. He hasn't always been at that point where this is about to occur. And if I think I see right, that's Mark Kaplan there. How are you? Have you moved out? Very nice. Those of you who haven't become acquainted with him should. With a name like that, there is also a history. And if anyone wants to know what the history of the Jewish community is, I think you should get acquainted with Mr. Kaplan, who has been a fine faculty member at Big Sandy. Now, the point is that I want to quickly summarize that you will discover, wherever messages are given, that the primary focus is on the fact that God is going to reestablish, through human beings born of God, his government, which has now been exercised only within the church, but then shall be, shall I use the strong word, imposed, and it will be on the world for its own good. Because it has been taken away long ago, and though offered to Adam, has not in fact been in force over the world for far longer than 6,000 years, because the one who became a devil or an adversary, Satan, had already established his idea of what government ought to be like long before he rebelled. And if you please, the government of God has been without direct administration over the whole globe for far longer than we can comprehend if we take a look at the impact of the government of the devil in terms of created nature. Because I draw to your attention that if the description in Isaiah of the natural world is correct, and it is, in which the child and the serpent and the ox and the bear and the leopard and the lion function in a manner that we do not now experience. And if the geological record also shows that Isaiah's description was not characteristic of the world even before Adam, we can look at the geological record and conclude, therefore, that the government of the devil has been here for most of the geological record during which there has been a biology on Earth. And on this basis, we are not dealing with the removal of God's government for a limited period of 6,000 years, but something of immense proportion. Because God was allowing it to happen when the angels were being tested, and now he is allowing it to happen when nations are being tested. And in the meantime, a few tens of thousands or scores of thousands of human beings are privately being tested and collectively as a church. The end result will be, through angels and the sons of God, the restoration of the government of God. But unfortunately, people who study prophecy have gotten their minds off of what God's intent and purpose is in the long range, and have gotten their minds on what the devil's program is and how he will carry it out. Now, there is a reason why we do need to be aware and not blind to what is going on about us. But I want you to understand the importance of those things which God is proposing and the incidental relationship of those things which men propose. We are told to watch in any number of cases. We are given prophecies here and there to be addressed to specific nations so that they may be warned of crises. But the primary focus ought now to be clear. The good news of the kingdom of God, which is the gospel, which is, of course, an anglicized term that is meant to convey the idea of good news, is the primary focus of prophecy. So that when we speak of what God proposes to grant eternal life, when we speak of the government and the laws of God, we are speaking far more of things which are prophetically important than the laws and the governments and the history of men. Moses, the lawgiver, was a prophet. David, the administrator, was a prophet. Jesus Christ was that prophet whom the Lord would raise up. He conveyed to us the message of the kingdom of God. I think we should see it in that perspective. But today I should like to address the questions that some have neglected. Recently, last 3 years or four, and I would like to address the questions that some of you are specifically interested in. I want to put it in the beginning in its proper focus. We're going to take a look at some aspects of the trend in world events and what the Bible says. We're going to take a look at the church's understanding, why the church has its varied points of view today, why some are overlooking some fundamental things. Today we live in a world in which there is a great confrontation with the Soviet Union. We live now in the 1970s. There are some of you who were born and think only in terms of events that took place since the Korean War at the beginning of the 1950s. No small number, in other words, of young people who are schooled today in college have no awareness consciously in their experience of anything prior to the close of the Korean War. You may even be married. You may even have children. And you have no conscious experience of events prior to that time. Some have that as their first conscious awareness of the world around. Some have the Second World War. Some also have the Depression. The Great Depression. Some, and far fewer in number, have a conscious awareness of the First World War. Peter Miller was, in fact, in Britain when it broke out and was therefore imprisoned in the Isle of Man during the period of the First World War. I doubt that any of you here have any real awareness of anything prior to the events leading up to the First World War. Now, I want to state that because these perspectives do determine very heavily how you look at events around you. And it determines the limitation of your thinking, or, put it another way, it also perhaps determines why you think certain things are more important than others, because it has been your experience, and anything else you've only heard with the hearing of the ear. I want to draw attention to the fact that today, if we are to look on the world scene apart from the Bible, It would be very difficult to conceive of an ultimate confrontation of nuclear war apart from a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union. Any role that China would play remains far down the line, for the simple reason that China is still essentially an agricultural nation. Without a fleet and an air force or a delivery system of any major or even significant conquest by comparison to the great powers. Thus, Israel today has an air force stronger than Britain or France, has an air force that is right after in rank and effectiveness anything that the United States or the Soviet Union could field. And yet Israel is an insignificant country in terms of size and population. We therefore discover, in looking at the world from the immediate perspective, that it would be unlikely to see in either France with atomic weaponry, Germany without, India with, and China with, any competition. We live in a world only of two superpowers. I'm not saying anything new. I am merely stating for you that the perspective of people today is something like that. Now, when we realize that approximately half of all people at any given time are 20 years and under, what we experience is that the majority of all people who are essentially aware of the world around us are individuals who have no conscious, direct awareness other than through reading and television and the movies of anything that happened prior to the close of the Second World War. In other words, everything is seen in a perspective by the overwhelming majority of living people today who are at the level of comprehending the world around us, of having an experience that is essentially limited. Apart from incidental reading and acquiring knowledge from others, essentially limited to a world in which the new sword of Damocles is the bomb and in which only two superpowers could ever use it by any stretch of the imagination that we now know and threaten the world. South Africa might, Israel might, India or Pakistan might, and China might, but the rest of the world could sneeze and very little would happen, because these nations are incidental. These are not the major nations, except as they become the focus of other powers. And if the great powers, the Soviet Union and the United States, decide to keep the peace, we call it Cold War or detente, the thing would be over shortly. And it depends solely on the character of the thinking of the leaders of the two great powers. Now, with this in mind, there has been a drift in the church, without a question, of individuals who have attempted to see, on one hand, sometimes perhaps a revival of an Arab Union of 10 nations, which is supposed to fulfill a prophecy of 10 powers. I am referring to the number 10 that recurs more than once in Revelation and or Daniel. Or that there is a great likelihood that any final revival of a prophetic beast is with the Soviet Union, because there isn't any other power. Logically, one might draw the conclusion, without the Bible, that this would be inevitably the case. I would cite for you that the British Israel World Federation an organization originally based in England, has viewed that the final confrontation will be between the United States and the Soviet Union. I would also point out that Mr. Armstrong has concluded over many years that indeed it would be that way if nothing would stop the Soviet Union. The question is there a message given in the Bible as a warning which man normally does not perceive in advance enough that would prevent what the Soviet Union has in mind? I will not answer that for the moment. It is not new for people who even understand our national identity to view a final confrontation from the North between the Soviet Union and the United States. So if this ideal lodges in the mind of some laymen and or in the ministry and the church, it is not new. It has been said many times before. It remains to be proved whether it will be true. You know, it's the old story pertaining to Abraham. It has not yet been proved that Abraham's faith paid off because he died not having received the promises, brethren, and he's still dead, unless one of you is Abraham. It has not been proved. That is the essence of faith. It is peculiar that at a time when an increasing percentage, albeit small, of the Church of God is doubting the national identity of the House of Israel, when a same small but increasing number doubt the real meaning of Matthew 24 and its parallel verses in Mark and Luke, and are concluding that the real confrontation the church either knows nothing about or it will be with the Soviet Union or we can't know at all, that the world has an increasing but small percentage of people who are aware of what the church has been teaching all along and are beginning to say it. It often happens, you see, that the more we multiply the Bible, the less we read it. The more the church spiritually dies, the greater the understanding of the world about the Bible. That's the way it was in the 18th and 19th centuries. And if we have individuals in the church who have lost confidence in the fundamental explanation of Scripture when it comes to what men in politics will do, God is still able to make it known even by people who don't obey Him, who have the wit to see. Because there were people in Europe, for instance, before the rise of Adolf Hitler to final power, who saw, without being converted, the direction that events were taking. Now what I want to do is let you know what has been happening that you may not have been as aware of, to enable you to see why the church perhaps said what it did in the manner in which it did. First, we draw to your attention the fact that in 1943 there was an intent for those who were in power in fascist Nazi Europe to establish a continuity by going underground. Now let me explain what we mean by underground. Anything which is underground operates above ground, because man is not a mole. Anything which is underground must seem to be far away while it is near. Anything which is underground would operate in the following fashion. If you don't want to be heard, you must be seen in a park. I'm speaking on an individual basis to give you an idea. You must be able to be seen. You must not be conspiring in some hidden area. You must be taken for granted as something else than you are. If you were in opposition, for instance, to the Nazis, the best place to be seated, if you were hungry, was at the table next to the SS troops. Because surely, if you were a part of the underground, you wouldn't be there. So when the Nazis went underground, as distinct from those whose faces were so obvious that they couldn't, who perished at the end of the war, they had to come in a manner such that instead of being a part of an obvious opposition conspiring in secret, they became our friends in public. That is what we mean by an underground. And if you don't understand it, then you don't understand why it is possible to have conspiracy at the political level. Thus, there was a time after the Cold War began with the Soviet Union that any people in Europe were challenged and had to prove that they were not in some way or another affiliated with the Communist Party. This was a very difficult thing because not everybody can prove he was a non-communist. And it was at this time, especially the beginning of the Korean War, that many Germans with scientific skills and other connections proved to the United States that they were clearly not communists by showing their former Nazi Party cards and were accepted in areas in which British socialists were even kept out because they couldn't prove they had not been in contact in some way with the Soviet Union. I only cite the fact that we lived very clearly with an awareness in the 40s and 50s in the Church of God that there was an underground and that it had in fact got hold of an opportunity to serve the United States in terms of its scientific skills. It did so even in terms of the skills to get to the moon. Whether we are fully aware of it or not, whether there is even an awareness on the part of the individuals involved that they were consciously a part of an underground. In 1953, a revolution took place that was crushed quickly in Germany. It was by a group who wanted to restore Nazism to Germany. And Adenauer prevented it. It shocked the West momentarily, but Adenauer, being an elder statesman, assured the West that there was no question that was misunderstood. Germany is a democratic state. And it was soon forgotten, the Naumann affair. We pointed up at this time the concern that the Vatican had with the crushing of the influence of Roman Catholicism in Eastern Europe. A fighting pope spoke out. Cardinal Mindszentius, remember, in the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, which opened a hole in the Iron Curtain, fled to the American embassy. The Pope was concerned. There was trouble clearly in Poland. A hole had been punctured, and the United States had been asking the peoples of Eastern Europe to throw off their shackles, and when they did, we stood with our hands folded and cheered them on. And when the Soviet Union in 1956 was assured that we would do nothing, only then did they intervene and send troops to crush the revolt in Hungary. Now you have to realize where the struggle was. It was not of any consequence in the Middle East. Oh, there was a problem between the Israelis and the French and the Egyptians and the English over the Suez. But apart from that, Britain was losing the Suez as we are about to donate the Panama Canal. The fact remains that you had the 1953 revolt in East Berlin, the Hungarian revolt in 56. You had revolts in several areas, many of which have been kept quiet in Poland. You had the deviation, I believe it is in 1968, with the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia to the point that the Soviet Union had to fly in troops at night to reoccupy the country. All during this period, there was a major period of a major area of confrontation in Eastern Europe. And there was this question of what Europe shall do. Now, in the meantime, there was the brief struggle in the Middle East in 1967, the Six-Day War, which took all the pressure off the Middle East because the Israelis now had room to maneuver, which they had none before. It was not long after this that we got involved heavily in Vietnam, which was the beginning of our undoing. And when indeed the world opinion went against the United States because we had the policy of fighting a third-rate nation in the north with one of our hands tied behind our back and then the other one was to help South Vietnam. Instead of doing what the Soviet Union did in Hungary and Czechoslovakia, we allowed a crisis to occur on the United States campuses. We allowed events to take place that ultimately led to our withdrawal from continental Southeast Asia and a conviction in the United States Congress that any great military invention now by the United States in peripheral areas of the world should not be allowed. We want to withdraw slowly from Korea. We will ultimately want to do the same thing with respect to Western Europe, but the time has not yet come to make such a recommendation. The point is, the Soviet Union initiated the Cold War, but told the rest of the world that we did, because we are trying to stop the movement of history, which is on the side of communism. And so we are blamed, even in the United States, in some circles, for initiating the Cold War, though I think the Americans, as a majority, would hardly agree with it. The Soviet Union's aim in the Cold War has not generally been understood. You fight a Cold War when you are unable to fight a hot one. In a Cold War, you act belligerent, but you never go beyond the capacity to withdraw safely. When you are so far away in terms of your capacity to win, you want to act as if you're very near to a confrontation. This is a rule of thumb. Now the Cold War is over. We have the next phase, which is assumed to be between the Cold War and peace. It's called détente. President Ford scuttled it, but it's still what is going on. Actually, détente is the phase between Cold War and Hot War. The Cold War was an effort to weaken the United States' resolve and conviction to the point where the Soviet Union would no longer have to seem as belligerent, and that we would be willing to compromise on the basis of trade and culture while the Soviet Union still supplies arms and ideology to revolutionary forces. I am here to say that the Soviet Union, as of this present period in time, has won the Cold War and it is over. Now let's get that clear. The Soviet Union has won the Cold War and it is over. The new phase is detente. The victory occurred when there was a major withdrawal of the United States from continental Southeast Asia. The proof of the success of the new phase that we call detente, in which the United States compromises in all of the unfortunate meaning of the term, and in which we do or acquiesce to what the Soviet Union wishes, is proved by events in Angola, and now, of course, in neighboring areas. For the first time, it is possible for the Soviet Union to do what it has never done before. They never sent their troops anywhere. Now they have been able to utilize and they have perceived the value of a Cuba with a heavy black population. And they are sending the blacks of Cuba to Africa as an expeditionary force in order to maintain communist-oriented governments in southern Africa. The United States, in fact, is less willing to act in this part of the world than even France was. And without the Muslim Moroccans and the French, there is no telling what would have happened in Zaire. As of the moment, détente is a state of mind and relationship in which the United States has capitulated and now is acting senile. The United States' behavior is that of senility. It waxes from strength to weakness, unaware of many things that are occurring around. We think of the prophecy of Britain with the gray hairs seeming to be old without realizing what has happened. The prophecy about Ephraim is a reference to what was then the leading tribe in Israel, and we are now the leading nation in the whole of the West, and the same is applicable to us. So at this moment, the Soviet Union is continuing to do what it has done, and that is to rot away control of very critical areas of the world from the West, by doing it without a hot war, acting belligerent to start with until it got its way and the West backed down, instead of the Soviet Union having to back down, and then offering the arm of trade and peace and human rights, while all the time pushing and pushing. And when they are pushed back in one case, then they move in another. If one nation doesn't want them any longer, then they go in another direction. But the United States no longer stops them. In other words, we are now in a position where the confrontation is no longer in Southeast Asia that is over. The confrontation isn't anywhere in Asia of any consequence. The confrontation now is in Africa. And when you have finally won your foothold and South Africa as a republic is isolated and much of the important critically situated and mineral wealthy area of the southern part of Africa below the Muslim countries is taken over, then you can be sure that for practical purposes the Soviet Union will have control of the Indian Ocean, the strategic minerals of the southern part of Africa, and will be moving into the southern half of the Atlantic. gradually encircling. The ultimate confrontation, as the Soviet Union sees it, is a blow at the United States without ever having to risk war with Europe. The hope is that Europe can remain divided and ultimately will fall prey to the communist parties within. And then whatever role South America plays will be incidental. South America has been made up of nations that have never liked us since we stripped the Latin world of Texas, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California. Our history is clear. What we wanted, we got. And if it wasn't worth it south of the border, we didn't bother with it. And they see our state of mind, as undoubtedly Esau saw Jacob, for what he was carnally. South America is not a critical area in terms of any role that the United States could play in, let's say, holding that as a bastion against the Soviet Union, because we don't have that kind of reputation there. We couldn't fall back on South America. With this in mind, we can say now that we are at a critical juncture in which we are either ultimately face to face with the Soviet Union in a showdown that will lead to a war which will not allow the fulfillment of prophecy, and the Church of God has indeed erred, and Christ himself, the speaker to John, the revelator, erred, and God erred in his message, or else we're going to have to take a look at the Bible on the one hand and what inevitably is going to occur on the other. At this stage, there is no question that the Catholic Church is in a very precarious situation, having for practical purposes lost real control politically and influentially in Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary. They are now limited to Western Europe, which has been infested with liberalism and socialist and communist ideas. The church has been torn asunder over the question of birth control, the authority of the bishops versus that of the pope, the question of how many traditions, such as Fish on Friday and the Mass in Latin, must go in order to maintain the new generation. It is a very serious situation for the Roman Catholic Church. I cite it because the history of civilization in Western Europe since the fall of Rome actually revolves around the role of the Catholic Church, culturally, religiously, educationally. At the same time, Western Europe today is trying to build a very important economic structure. Interestingly, the focus has been internal in trying to break down the barriers between all the nations in Europe proper, while at the same time, France and England, let's count them, and Holland and Belgium, we're not including Germany and Italy, but France and England and Holland and Belgium, these are nations which had once prior to and through and until just after the Second World War, major empires. When they focused in on a union in Europe, they actually got their minds on their local problems, which were so immense that they have lost, sooner or later, their empires. And now they are extending helping hands to former colonies, in many cases successfully, but in other cases not. And in some instances, the most important colonies are those over which now they have the least influence. That is in the southern half of Africa. Europe has been focusing in on itself. It has been unable to resolve its internal problems. We expected events to happen much sooner because Europe was under pressure. The Soviet Union was putting Europe under pressure. But within the period of time that détente has occurred, the most remarkable thing is also developing. Communist parties are growing in influence in Western Europe internally. The Soviet Union is arming more and more effectively, and only recently, in the last few weeks at most, has deployed new weapons that make it more difficult to, let's say, to destroy, because they are not limited to silos or fixed positioning. But Europe is doing nothing about it because the Soviet Union is talking détente. And the Soviet Union has convinced, in a sense, a whole generation of Americans and West Europeans, young people who have grown up, that they have lived with the Cold War so long, there surely isn't anything to it to be ultimately concerned about. And a sufficient number have been convinced that the nations are foot dragging. Now we must then ask the simple question. Is it possible that in a situation in which the Soviet Union could overrun Europe immediately, within a matter of days, not weeks, the Soviet Union has the capacity to overrun all of Western Europe in a matter of days?
The Soviet Union is so aware of this that ultimately, as far as they are concerned,
the real blow must fall on the United States. Europe still relies on the United States and is more interested in trade and commerce than in protecting themselves as one of two great pillars, North America on the one hand and Europe on the other, to combat the Soviet Union. The voice of Franz Josef Strauss is heard less and less in a Germany that isn't that interested, because they're so interested in their own economic situation. And as long as the United States is the basis for the economic revival of Europe, as long as the United States appears strong enough to carry the umbrella of civilization, it is the same way with Japan. These nations are not attempting to resolve their military situation. And therefore, there can be no fulfillment of biblical prophecy in terms of Revelation and Daniel and a revival of a Roman system. But now I draw to your attention a particular verse in Revelation which says, there is a beast which you saw, Revelation 17:8, which was and is not and shall ascend out of an abyss. And it goes into perdition, this time permanently. And those who dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And that will include no small number in the church of God, because when the servants of the king, as we saw last night, call people to the wedding, they gather the good and the bad. And no small number in the church are even going to wonder, because they couldn't believe it. Now, why should this be true? If this is the Soviet Union, then those who dwell on the earth have no reason to wonder. It's been obvious all along what communism has had in mind. The only thing is that you see here a system which shall cause such shock in the world, because it is totally unexpected, that the nations are not prepared even to accept the possibility until it happens. I think that verse is so obvious,
in telling us the nature of a final political event that either the Bible is wrong or practically everything that must happen will happen so suddenly because it is being planned underground, figuratively speaking, planned in meetings where we can't see the consequences, though they may be reported on. I think we have to beware of the fact that, let's say, a small percentage of the church grew up with the experience of what was going on when the remnants of a power at the end of the Second World War were scattered and beaten and broken and destroyed politically. And when those remnants set about to rebuild, and they have been lost in the struggle that has occurred meantime, let us then go back to an interesting event. You see, the prophet Isaiah said to Hezekiah that Babylon would destroy Jerusalem. And at that time, Assyria was a great power, had come and attacked Jerusalem already in the period of time of Sennacherib. No sooner had Isaiah given his prophecy that Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, destroyed Babylon. And in the 680s B.C., there was not even a Babylon to fulfill the prophecy. And it was not then until the close of his reign that the city came to be restored little by little. Today, we see the same thing. Fascism, in a sense, is gone. It's even removed today from Portugal and Spain and whatever there might have been in Greece. And we don't see it at all. It seems the most illogical thing that could ever be reborn in Western Europe, that is governed by faceless bureaucrats of a socialist orientation. But it happened. In that day. And it's going to happen again, or the Bible is not true. There is an interesting prophecy we have on occasion discussed in Isaiah chapter 23. It is a prophecy about Tyre. And it tells about a period of 70 years in which Tyre has played no role. I have given a whole sermon on this years past. It is the story of ancient Tyre, which was a commercial community. It had its own religion. Melkart was the king of the city. The devil in Isaiah is pictured as the king of Babylon, Isaiah 14. The devil is pictured as the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28. Therefore, we may draw a conclusion that there is something significant here. When it says that it comes to pass after the end of 70 years, verse 17, that the Lord will visit Tyre and she shall turn to her hire. This is then described as a woman, isn't it? A prostitute who makes her living by hiring herself out. And she shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. After 70 years. And her merchandise and her hire shall ultimately be holiness to the Lord. It shall not be treasured or laid up for others, for her merchandise shall be for those that dwell before the Lord. And the implication is that she will ultimately make her headquarters at Jerusalem, where this particular system's wealth will be provided for those who are the people of God. Now, let's go back to verse 15 of this chapter. It shall come to pass in that day when Tyre is in fact revived, that it will be set. The Tyre will be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king's life. You know, David lived for 70. 70 was an ordinary length of life. Tyre will be forgotten, but at the end of 70 years, she will sing again as a harlot. The song will be, take a harp, go about the city, you harlot who has been forgotten, make sweet melody, sing many songs that you may be remembered. Now we have the role then of what was once a commercial power, here pictured as a religious power, playing the role of a prostitute. But that is also a political power, as Tyre was, that is involved in trade. In other words, it is a church that is a state that is also involved heavily in commerce, characteristic of Tyre. And for 70 years, this system is forgotten. Now, there is such a woman described in Revelation 17. A woman here, a woman there. This one hires herself out and commits fornication. That one does the same thing in Revelation 17. The implication, it's the same power. Now, I would only suggest that 70 years are indeed 70 years. And there was a time in the last century, beginning in 1859, when a particular power was shorn of the various states that it possessed, and its leader was imprisoned within its own public building. And 70 years after the decline of a religious power that dominated Italy, in 1929, Benito Mussolini arranged a new concordat. And that power, which was for all this time, in a sense, politically imprisoned within the walls of a city-state, gained a recognition and a reputation, and has been on the world scene since. But, like a woman who has lost some of the flower of her youth, it has been difficult to maintain that reputation. I'm speaking in riddles for reasons. The wise do understand. That 70 years was in fact an absolute fulfillment. You can read the story of the events that were occurring then. After the restoration to prominence, beginning with the Concordat in 1929, it was a few years later that a man by the name of Benito Mussolini proclaimed the empire with which a concordat had been arranged for this church as the Roman Empire restored. And of course, I brought to your attention Mr. Smith's book called Mussolini's Roman Empire. Now what we see, in other words, is a state of affairs in which a religious power is going to play a major role, but is not at this moment able to do so because it doesn't have any creature on which politically to ride. That is, Revelation 17 speaks of a beast which a woman rides. And this woman, unfortunately, has to get off the beast from time to time because the beast has its revivals, and then it has been out of power. It has ceased because it has been in some way politically defeated. Then it gets back on this system again. That's the implication. At this moment in time, we have, of course, the ultimate weapon that is economic, which is oil in the Middle East. The other is, without a doubt, the question of whether the United States will continue to be able to exercise the role of military umbrella over the whole of the West. We, at this moment, can say that from month to month, as we read the news, there is no basic change except that the Soviet Union keeps pushing and pushing, and we keep withdrawing and withdrawing. We are not going to maintain the kind of hold on the Panama Canal that would have made this nation great. Britain lost the Suez. We are going to gradually lose the South Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. It's going to be only a matter of time in which the Soviet Pacific Fleet is going to be able to challenge us, as they already are well able to do in the Mediterranean. You have a situation in which great fleets side by side are going to be in all the major oceans. And when the Soviet Union is prepared to say that there could be no risk, then it is either now or never for the rest of the world. Because if Europe discovers that the Soviet Union not only has parity, but has the capacity to inflict such a devastating blow that it cannot lose, because it has acquired power in the Atlantic, the Indian, and the Pacific Oceans, it has in fact cut the links of trade, though it might leave it possible, but cut the links in terms of who controls it. Can exercise influence in the Suez, the Red Sea, the route around South Africa, can exercise control in the Mediterranean and in the Caribbean and Pacific, then the question will arise. At what point will the Soviet Union decide to make a move? At this point, I would draw the conclusion that we must wait and see. It is very probable, in my estimation, that the Soviet Union will not be able to reach that point of confrontation with the United States, where the issue will be the European revival militarily in order to defend itself. That it will not reach that point before something else happens. Because if it does, then I see no reason why the focus should be on Jerusalem in the Middle East. It is very probable that before the Soviet Union reaches that capacity, that you will see a situation in which Arab and Jewish tempers cannot be controlled. And the flare-up will occur there that will provoke an event that will take place before the Soviet Union is totally militarily prepared. I think this is inevitable on the basis that the confrontation is not over Europe itself, but over Jerusalem. All the nations are going to be sucked in to a final holocaust that focuses on Jerusalem, not Panama, not the control of the North Atlantic, not the safety of nations in Western Europe alone. It is the control of Jerusalem. Shall it be a city internationalized? Shall it belong to one of the Arab states? Shall it be dominated by a religious power? It appears that all nations are going to be drawn into the vortex of Jerusalem before any of them are adequately prepared to determine how they ought to behave. Calm minds which can make decisions before a crisis usually resolve a crisis. Europe, if it were to unite today at a time of relative peace, would probably never fulfill Revelation 17 because it would be built up on the basis of calm minds, intellectual men, businessmen, who are able to create that which could survive. It is the fact that the United States is backing away and becoming senile, that the Soviet Union is marching and marching through other people while they stay within their own frontiers. They're marching in Africa through the Cuban troops. That is a very important state of affairs there. We now have a new power under Mr. Begin, Menachem Begin in Israel. And the Arabs are quite upset, and Begin has apparently decided, at this point at least, that he's going to take a hard line, and we're going to see how far the Arabs are going to tolerate it. If we wait so long that a crisis occurs in the Middle East in which the Arabs use the oil weapon as the South against Europe, the North, there is an inevitability that Europe may have to act. And I think this is the case. So that the most important news in the world today, apart from any work we are doing, is the fact that the Arab nations are now being called the South, and Europe, with its industrial states, the North. And this goes hand in hand with Daniel chapter 11. There is no one king of the South. There is an area called the South, which is in a sense Muslim. And the South is going to push at the North, and Europe cannot stand to have this occur economically. That is the area to watch, and the reason they're going to do it is that the South is going to back the Palestinians, who want Jerusalem back and the West Bank made a Palestinian state. And however the Arabs may finally come out to agree on what they want, the inevitability is they're going to use again oil as a weapon. And Europe is going to be forced to make Israel obey. This is the case. Europe is going to have to move, on the one hand, to seemingly protect Israel and the Christian area in it and the nation itself, but is going to force Israel to do what the Israelis are not willing to do themselves. And that is going to be the price that the Europeans will pay in order to have access to Arab oil. To do that, the Europeans must march into the Middle East and occupy the Holy Land. But for Europe to do this means that the Russians cannot stand idly by and see a power in Europe suddenly expand militarily into the Middle East, where the possibility is that Russian influence can be nullified. Because if the Arabs and the Europeans get together and the Israelis are forced to live within limited confines, this means that the Soviet Union has lost leverage in the Middle East. Because if the Arabs get together with Europe, then Russia is way back, whereas she once was a major power in Syria and in Egypt, she can be forced back, so that it does seem to me that we have to recognize that the Soviet Union is also going to make a move in the Middle East to protect its rights. The Soviet Union is soon going to be a power that must import oil as well. If this is the case, the United States doesn't want any major power sending troops to the Middle East. And if the President of the United States had warned Nixon, remember, had warned the Soviet Union to send no troops in the Middle East, that it would lead to a confrontation called war. The United States would not stand for sending our troops as peacekeepers. We would not stand for the Soviets. But if the Europeans, the temperament that they have, do send troops to safeguard themselves economically from the pressure of the Arabs, the Russians are not about to stay out and would have to send troops certainly into Iraq to safeguard the Persian Gulf. The United States would be at odds with Europe without any question, and the next move would be very simple. The Soviet Union would come to terms with Europe on the premise that if Europe is willing to acknowledge the presence of the Soviet Union will acknowledge the right of Western Europe and would demand that it be independent of the United States, and the power of both would be put together to destroy this country. And for the first time, the inner secrets that we share with Europe would be made available to the Soviet Union. Remember that Napoleon and Russia divided the world. Remember that in August 1939, 1 month and less, matter about 3 weeks, before World War II began, while the United States was over here, the French and the British had gone to Moscow to make an arrangement to try to have a final curb to keep Hitler from putting pressure on Poland. The Russians announced to the world while the West was there that von Ribbentrop of Germany had arranged an agreement with the Soviet Union, and anything with the West was off. And Poland was divided in 3 weeks, and World War II was here. Within a month's time, that's how quickly it could happen. The United States could be put in a position where the great powers would be repeating what they had done before, and we would be confronted then with the military power of the Soviet Union allied with Europe. And we would suddenly discover what we never knew, that those who have in fact been our friends on the other side of the Atlantic have turned to be our enemies, because we could not be trusted to guarantee them their economic power, and we were willing to sell them down the stream economically because we have enough to take care of ourselves if we had to. We have our oil. And to keep anybody out, we would be willing to let the Arabs put this kind of pressure on them. I think we have to see it from that perspective, because we're not about to risk war with the Soviet Union merely to save the industrial states of Europe. This is not a very pretty picture. And right now, with detente, it doesn't seem we even need to paint it. Except that it's like this, that all the pieces are lying in front, and all we have to do is suddenly assemble them. Nobody is assembling them yet because the United States is still offering an opportunity. The Israelis haven't made a final move, and the Arabs are not yet prepared to put this kind of pressure on until they see whether or not any other solution will work. We must keep our eyes open. I think it is time we took a look at the potential consequences. I've tried to paint it reasonably clearly on the premise of what we can know in the world and a little bit of past history. And the role of the church, of course, I have kept minimal in this. But obviously, we're going to be confronted with the need of a power in Europe which is going to come up with the idea of how to save Europe, how to solve the problem of the Middle East, and it isn't going to be left alone to the politicians. In the meantime, we must guard ourselves internally against a drift in the direction that we can't know where we are. We are a lot closer to the problem that seems so far away. If it seemed near, the world wouldn't be shocked. But it's so far away because people do not see how it can be assembled together, for they have no knowledge of what the Bible says, and men on the world scene who are going to execute it may not now even be in power. For all we know, there may be a series of revolutions. Who would ever have thought that the empire of Europe, sorry, the emperor of Europe, by 1800 would be Napoleon, when he was not long before an obscure general who had to flee from the eastern Mediterranean? It can happen so quickly. Who would have thought in 1923 that a prisoner having to have someone else help him write a book would in 16 years precipitate a world war? That was Adolf Hitler. The man who may ultimately, the leader who may ultimately do these things, we may never even have heard his name yet. And it can happen that quickly. Ideas have a way of suddenly taking root. The world is guided today by men with very few ideas and no solutions. And there will arise a power influenced by the devil which will come up with all kinds of proposed solutions and ideas that will sweep a whole area of the world off its feet. I hope all of you will keep reading. I'm sure that the News Bureau will be doing its part. And I've given you enough guideline today that I think that you can follow through if we never had a subject now any longer. I think it's enough of a guideline that you have no reason to be without sight.